Blog Talk Radio.
Hello everyone, this is Peter Paul Brizola. We had a new theme, which instead we'll switch it at the end of the program. We're taking the program in a different direction. This is a banner day today, August 17th, for birthdays. Last week we didn't have as many prominent ones. So let me run by that because some of them have quite an impact even today on our lifestyles and our history. In 1786, Davy Crockett was born today. Maybe that's why they had the Alamo on free TV last night, the teasers that they offer you on cable TV, those of you who have it. Of course, the Alamo, there are three versions. The first version was done back in the silent film days, and I have a copy of that. I haven't looked at it yet, but it's in the archives. And then the second one was done about 1960 with John Wayne. Great film. A lot of its history romanticized. And then there's a third version that just came out a couple years ago. Pretty brutal, but and it showed after the Alamo what it had, how Sam Houston, who used Wellington tactics to defeat General Santa Anna, who was considered himself the Napoleon of the West. As a matter of fact, I think it was San Jacinto where he was defeated by the Sam Houston and the band of irregulars, you can call them that. Santa Anna had to sign over Texas. He was deposed as president, El Presidente, or dictator of Mexico, and then he came back and was deposed again, typical of what went on down in Mexico and Latin America. But here's a little thing about Texas people don't know. It's not only a boom and bust economy and oil, but it's the first place when the Franciscan monks came up from Mexico, they started the first wineries in Texas. They weren't started in California. Also, about that time in the 15th century, when the Spanish conquered the Philippines, renamed it the Philippines after King Philip II of Spain, and of course Magellan got eaten there. They impressed these young Filipinos and on the ships, just like the British did later, and treated them brutally. So Mexico was considered Mexico City was the administrative capital in North America, in the West, for Spain. So, like, if there was a decision that needed appeal to the King of Spain or to what they call Madrid, it would have to first go through Mexico City, and then from Mexico City they would sail to Spain. It took about a month or so. But when the Philippine boys, youths, were impressed on the Spanish galleons, they were treated brutally. And so when the Spanish galleons first sighted the ship like land like they did in the Gulf of Mexico, the Filipino boys would jump ship. And maybe some of them intermarried. This has happened with other groups that have jumped ship or landed in strange countries. They intermarry with the natives. And maybe there are. So the Filipinos were actually the first Asians to arrive that we know of to arrive in North America. It wasn't the Chinese. So that's something that's a little part of Filipino American history that's not well known. Let's see, who else is born today? We had Frederick Russell. He's the guy who invented a vaccine to deal with typhoid fever, born in 1870. And then there's a lot of interesting birthdays this day, August 17th. Eric Drummond, he was the first secretary of the League of Nations, and of course that was a disaster because, you know, for one reason, Congress would not approve the treaty that Wilson negotiated without, President Woodrow Wilson negotiated without taking the senator, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was the majority leader. And so they decided to sabotage his efforts, and maybe it was a good thing, I don't know. In San Francisco, we have the UN was founded here, and we'll get into why the UN was not located here. Rockefeller did offer a building in New York, a site, and that's where it is today. But a lot of people wanted the UN to be in San Francisco, but there's a very practical reason it isn't, and I'll get into it with it. An interview that I did with the late, great Mayor George Christopher, founder of Derry. He's the guy who also saved diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Russia after the ill-fated U-2 Francis Gary Powers spy mission. And, of course, that's prominent 50 years ago this week because Vincent Hallinan, father of the Hallinan brothers, three of them are lawyers, very controversial, so at least one's a crook. That's Terrence, and also known as Kale. He was the Communist Party's presidential candidate in 1952, and he was also in prison on Terminal Island up in Washington State. But he was the longtime lawyer for the International Longshoremen's Union, a union that had been infested from top to bottom with criminal elements. And this movie, On the Waterfront, although that is about New York, is also can apply to San Francisco. And Harry Bridges, the Australian communist, who used Vincent Hallinan to avoid deportation, which would have happened. I didn't know Vincent Hallinan personally, but I do know his sons, two of them anyway. And one thing Vincent Hallinan said, and this applies to anybody, whether you're a lawyer or not, or you have to do your own legal work, that a case is 90% preparation and 10% trial in a courtroom. So that's something to remember. And I always tell people from my own experience that the important thing is the research that has done, research and investigation that is done for a lawyer. Most lawyers, the majority of lawyers, either don't do it or don't have the time to do it. And some of them are very good mouthpieces in court. But the important thing is, and I always ask this and I tell people who are looking for lawyers, find out how he does his research, if he does it, or if he or she, what's it going to cost you, or how much time is involved, and you know, how thorough, what are the issues that have to be covered, and is there relevant case law out there and what needs to be investigated. So we'll get into that another time because I've got almost 50 years' experience with this. The other birthday today, again, it's the black nationalism, Marcus Garvey, who used to dress up like look like a African general. And he was, I think he called it the Pan-African movement. He wanted to bring blacks back to Africa or encourage them. And that's something that Abe Lincoln wanted to do. In fact, he was for deporting the blacks, transporting blacks a long time before he became president. And he also said, and this is one of the things that is not talked about, that in the Emancipation Proclamation, Abe Lincoln gave the South a timeline. He said, if they come back into the Union, they'll work out the slave issue. And if they don't, then slaves in all areas conquered and occupied by the Union Army would be free. And we discussed, I went into that the last show. But that's one of the things about Abe Lincoln and freeing the slaves, or Father Abraham, the son of the historical idolaters, view Abe Lincoln. Abe Lincoln was a very shrewd railroad lawyer. That's also not talked about. He got the state capital of Illinois moved from Vandalia to Springfield. He worked for the Illinois Central Railroad, which in those days, a railroad lawyer was a license to steal and do all kinds of other things. And how he got the nomination in Chicago at the Republican convention, the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, McCormick family of the Reapers, McCormick Reaper tractor equipment and that, hired the biggest loudmouths, people, who, guys whose voices could carry in the old amphitheater, which used to be on the south side of Chicago, near downtown, and they would he placed them at strategic points in the hall, and they would bellow out Lincoln, Lincoln, and Lincoln. That's how Lincoln got the nomination, among other tactics that were used at the time. Other great birthdays today: two great actors, and Monty Woolley. He's the guy. Great film he made, The Man Who Came to Dinner. He was English. He was gay. He used to haunt the New York scene, looking for black sailors. He was a great friend of Cole Porter. He's in the movie Cole Porter, playing himself. I think he was a Yale professor, taught English, and he did have this proclivity. And he was a bon vivant. Quite a guy. And then Mae West was born today in 1892. And, a great actress. She was a Roman Catholic. A lot of people don't know that. And buried in the Catholic Church. And I don't know of any incidents in her whole life where she took her clothes off or did the Little Egypt, who was a stripper or an exotic dancer, I guess you could call her. And then in 1905, we had the birthday of John Hay Whitney. He was a publisher of the New York Herald Tribune. Now, the Herald Tribune doesn't exist anymore. Went to funk. But Americans who were in Europe or expatriates or traveled to Europe, when they wanted an American paper, this paper was available in Europe, and that's what Americans abroad read, the Herald Tribune. And they had some great writers, great correspondents. And this is an interesting birthday and death. Franklin Delano Roosevelt Jr., his first son, was born on this day, and he also died on this on his birthday, I think in 1962, if I'm not mistaken. And he's the guy you see in the picture. He's in a naval uniform, usually holding his father, supporting his father who was standing up and didn't want to be seen as a cripple. Also, one other thing about FDR, he was the first presidential candidate. The Chicago's had more presidential conventions than any other city in U.S. history. And he flew to Chicago, it was the first time it was done, to accept the nomination. Now, it's interesting, about the same time Adolf Hitler took these airplanes to fly around Germany, and the great, I guess she was, I didn't know any better, was an artist, Leni Riefenstahl, did all these films, Triumph of the Will, Distriumph, Dis Villain, a lot of great films. Some people consider her an evil woman, great cinematographer, but the film that she did when Hitler was flying, I think it was to Nuremberg, great shots and everything, and I think maybe it's been rumored by some historians that FDR imitated Hitler. Of course, they were all in the same time period, Hitler, Churchill, Stalin, Chiang Kai-shek. Great history. And then the guy who did the famous picture of Washington crossing the Delaware, Larry Rivers, he was born in 1923. And here's a birthday, I don't know, this guy used to be a good actor, Sean Penn, who was in the film Harvey Milk, which was a cinematic scam because Harvey Milk used to use drugs. He was called the mayor of Castro. And the reason he was called the mayor of Castro because he was a drug dealer. And he was in the U.S. Navy. He signed in when he was, his parents signed him in when he was 17. Same thing that my brother, half-brother was signed in to the U.S. Army. And later went into the Air Force after his tour was up. But Harvey Milk served in the U.S. Navy, but later on he claimed he was gay all along. We don't know what his I think he got an honorable discharge, what they call a DD-214. That's the form. But it just goes to show that there were gays in the military. A lot of them came out to San Francisco or were stationed out here or passed through going on to the Pacific or up to Alaska. But it just goes to show that there were guys who kept their mouth. They were gay in their private life, kept their mouth shut, their sleeves down, their underwear on, and their zippers up. There wasn't this politicization of sexual preference. And also at this time, or before 10 years before America got into war, or not 10, but 7, Captain Ernest Rome, he was a guy who was open homosexual, liked young boys. He was a hero. He was decorated in World War One. He knew Hitler maybe in more ways than we know about or people talk about. But he was the guy who is probably the political godfather of open gays. And I don't know about the lesbians, but there were lesbians in Nazi Germany. And that's starting, historians are starting to look at that. But he was the guy who had the, I can't pronounce the German, S.A., is the initial, and he had a homosexual army of about 300,000 young men. And there's an episode in German history, modern German history, called the Night of the Long Knives, when everybody was fed up with the outrages, the extortion, the perversion of Ernest Röhm and his boys, and Hitler decided to wipe out, give Himmler the go-ahead, because Himmler considered Röhm a competitor, a threat to his power. And so Himmler's SS went to this villa, a resort area outside Munich, and caught these guys literally and figuratively with their pants down and in bed with young boys and all of that. And Röhm was killed in the cell. He was brought back to SS jails or prison in, I think, Munich. But he was the guy that said Hitler was too conservative. He really believed in, quote, national socialism, and that's what we're facing here in the United States today. Now, among the worst judicial outrages, in fact, the trial was a rigged kangaroo trial. In 1915, Leo Frank was a New York Jewish businessman who went down south to set up a factory. And Jews were disliked. I think this was in Georgia, if I'm not mistaken. And he was accused of raping and killing a young white girl. And they really dumped on him because he was Jewish. And he was lynched. And the governor of the state at the time, there's a famous movie, I forgot the name of it, shame on me, with Jack Lemmon played the governor, one of his straight roles, no pun intended. There wasn't any humor to this. And he refused, he tried to block the execution, and what happened was there was so much of the Ku Klux Klan and the anti-Semitic feeling that Leo Frank was lynched. Well, they later found out, ironically, that it wasn't Leo Frank that had raped and killed this young girl who worked in the factory. It was the black janitor. I don't know what happened to him, because blacks who lynched whites were usually castrated, strung up and burned and hanged and tortured. All these horrible things happened, but this is one of the ironic twists of American injustice, the Leo Frank case, and forgot the name of that film, but anyway, I'll remember it next time. And then of the great musical lyricist, the brother of George Gershwin, who died in his 30s, but he did a lot of work. He also went to Paris, probably read the Herald Tribune. Ira Gershwin died today. And then getting back to the old Nazis, Rudolf Hess, who was the number two man in the Hitler regime, and he's the one, you see these famous photos of him. He did have a son. He took off, we don't know if Hitler knew about it, but he took off in a plane to Scotland to try to talk to the British, who were sympathetic to the Nazis and to having a standoff or a compromise with Adolf Hitler. Of course, Churchill was bellowing, you know, no deals, and you know, Nazism and all that. But the British didn't buy it, and they were fed up, and he was in prison. And then after the war, he was tried at Nuremberg, and he was not hanged because he was considered to be insane, but they put him in Spandau prison. And there's ironically, there's this German, I think it's a German rock group called Spandau. And he was there since 1948, I think. And he died, all the other German Nazis had been freed or had served their time. Admiral Dönitz, Albert Speer, von Schirach, who was the head of the Hitler Youth. His mother was American, by the way, and he was a bisexual. But all four occupying powers in Berlin took turns in guarding Spandau Prison, and it just got to be a huge expense, and the Americans wanted to turn him over to the Germans. He could serve his time out in a German prison, but the Russians wouldn't go for it. And so he died mysteriously a couple of years ago. And his family has never really talked about what they thought happened. There's been rumors that he was relieved of, delivered from this world, as it were. And let's see, what else happened today? Yes, I told you FDR Jr. died today on his birthday. And then interview that I did with the last commanding general of the Bengal Lancers, it would be very interesting. I like to surmise that if Brigadier Engel, the last British general who spent over 30 years out there in the Northwest Frontier and Pakistan, what is now Pakistan, and he was one of the founders of the Pakistan Military Academy, where General Zia, who died mysteriously in a plane crash on this day, it would be interesting to see what kind of reaction David Cameron would have, the new Prime Minister of England. A lot of the British want their forces out because the history of the West and the Russians in Afghanistan has been disastrous for everybody involved. The British got their butts kicked four times. And the best we can do, in my opinion, is to contain the bastards up there. It's just an unwinnable situation, and it's bleeding us dry, but we can't let them spread their terror and intimidation, shakedowns, and their Sharia law, anywhere in the world. You know, if they want to do it in Afghanistan, and the Afghan people don't want to or can't or won't, get rid of the Taliban, which are a bunch of sexual perverts. They like young boys. One of the British papers, I think it was the London Times, published an article about the contradictions of how they stone women who they accuse of adultery and immorality, yet they seem to tolerate this pedophilia. And the young boys are called little birds. I forgot the Afghan word for it. But also the New York Times had an article on that. And it's just this rampant hypocrisy of these Islamists, these Muslims. Not all are like that, but there's too many that still are. And then the feds got even with the Confederates. In 1863, the Federal Navy bombarded Fort Sumter. Remember, Fort Sumter was... where the war started, Confederates started to shell Fort Sumter, which is in Charleston, South Carolina Harbor. Ironically, the commander of the fort was a guy from the South, Captain Anderson, but he was pro-Union, like many of them were. And, in 1870, the first woman magistrate, I think, in the United States, in Wyoming. She was appointed, Esther Morris. And then those of you who love getting back to music, probably the greatest opera and one of the longest pieces of music ever written in the whole trilogy, Die Götterdämmerung, Wagner, was debuted at Bayreuth. I had been there, but I didn't get a chance to listen to anything I passed through on my way to Austria. And then in 1896, we had the Klondike. It was a gold was found up there, and there was a rush up to the Yukon and Alaska. And then in 1908, and this is relevant today, what became the Bank of America was started by Giannini and his daughter. He had a son, and then his daughter was on the board of directors, and she died. And then Bank of America, which was the premier, the biggest bank in the country until it was overtaken by Citibank in New York. Bank of America is no more as Giannini knew it. Now, what had happened was the Italian immigrants, legal or otherwise, could not get loans from the gringo bankers here in San Francisco. So Giannini started a banking operation, and of course it was trust, it was cultural, it was tribal. And in the San Francisco earthquake, he got his money out of the building in North Beach and saved the assets of his bank, and then went on to innovative marketing, becoming the biggest bank in California, the biggest bank in San Francisco, biggest bank in California, and the biggest in the United States, and one of the biggest in the world, but no more. And then in 1945, this is relevant, and it gets back to also, it's relevant to Mr. O, Indonesia under Sukarno declared its independence from the Dutch, and the Dutch were wise. They got out. Basis of the Queen of the Netherlands, Beatrix, she's the richest woman in the world, was from the resources of Indonesia, the shell oil. It used to be called Royal Dutch Shell, but they don't use that anymore, that title, but that's where the Dutch royal family's wealth has come from, primarily from the colony of Indonesia. And then one of my favorite presidents, Big Bong, Sukarno, and he certainly liked women. He used the term, which I think is very applicable to countries just discovering democracy and have newly independent, called guided democracy, that these people do not have the British and American or even French traditions or experience of participatory democracy. But Big Bong, Sukarno, just got too depraved with his bevy of women. They deposed him. And, of course, then the Suharto family, General Suharto, had an overthrow. Then the communists were always very big there. And there's a famous movie with, of all people, Mel Gibson, called The Year of Living Dangerously. It gets into the revolution in Indonesia, and I would recommend it, as I recommend films, that art is true to life. And then we have, and this has come up again, although the morons in the media are not covering or they're suppressing this Bradley Manning, a U.S. Army private who had incredible access to communications. And he's the guy who leaked all this stuff to this wiki-wacky, as somebody called it. And endangered the lives of our informants and operatives in Afghanistan. I don't agree with the war, but you don't do this either. Anyway, Bradley Manning's motivations apparently was he's gay. He wanted to have a transsexual operation. His lover jilted him, so he's mad at everybody. So this is apparently his way of striking back. It's worse than that Muslim doctor in the U.S. Army who killed those people at was it Port Hood in Texas. But people don't realize that or are not that aware that there's been a long, at least 100 years, of homosexual treachery dealing with national security, dating back to the Dreyfus case and Esterhazy back in 1890. Then there was the Colonel Radel case in Austria, where he was the head of Austrian national security, military security. He liked young boys, young cadets, and he was compromised by the Russian spy network of the Tsar at the time, and he sold a lot of the Austrian secrets, and the Austrian counterintelligence discovered it, and there's a famous movie about him anyway. And he was forced to commit suicide. But we've had problems in World War One, where Germans, Kaiser spies in New York, tried to compromise U.S. Navy sailors working in New York. We had the case in World War Two, similar. And then we had these communists, the Burgess and McLean, the British communists, Philby. And then today, in 1948, Alger Hiss, who worked in the State Department, was trusted by the Secretaries of State, Cordell Hull, Stettinius, Jimmy Burns, George Marshall, and Harvard grad, and he claimed he wasn't a communist. Well, then Whittaker Chambers, who was gay, became converted from communism, and he exposed Alger-Hiss, who committed perjury in testimony before Congress, and was prosecuted successfully and went to jail. After he got out of jail, out of Prelude prison, he sold printing in New York and died in disgrace, and his son is trying to rehabilitate his reputation. And then in 1962, those of us who remember the Berlin Wall, when these Germans wanted to get out of that horrible place run by this guy Olbricht, Peter Fechter, 18 years old, he was the first victim of the East German military, or Stasi. He tried to escape through the Berlin Wall, and he was shot and killed. This is one of those unfortunate things. I've been asked to repeat one of my favorite interviews, and so let's listen to the Clydesdales.
Hi friends, this is Peter Paul, and on this Sunday morning I've got a surprise treat for you. I'm talking to Lloyd Ferguson of the Budweiser Clydesdale Horses. Welcome to the program. Hi Lloyd.
How do you do this morning?
Lloyd, why did Budweiser choose these particular horses?
Well, I would have to say because they consider these Clydesdales pretty much the Rolls Royce of the draft horse breed. They have a natural high-stepping action. They got the four white feathered legs, white faces, deep bay color. They range in height from 17 up to 19 hands tall and average around a ton in weight.
What's a draft horse?
A draft horse is a large type of horse, generally 800 up to 1,000 pounds heavier than a light horse, and originally their main purpose was for pulling heavy loads and working in our fields. They were replaced by our trucks and tractors of today.
So when Budweiser originally started as a brewery, these horses were used?
Yes, they at one time did deliver Budweiser with the horses, and then later on become a advertising vehicle in 1933, and this year is our 50th anniversary for having the Clydesdale travel.
Of course, the horses aren't that old. What is that longevity?
They can live up to 20 years.
20 years? What's the average age of the horses that you use?
Right now, the average of this team that we have with us is, I guess, around 7 years old.
How many horses do you have totally?
We have 10 with us here right now. There are three teams in the nation, and
they're constantly on tour.
Yeah, they travel all the time. Our home base is in Southern California, south of Riverside, a place called Romoland, California. They have a team based in St. Louis, Missouri, and one in Merrimack, New Hampshire.
What do these horses eat? Do they get anything special?
They eat around 50 pounds of feed a day. They get a mixture of crimped oats, bran, and beet pulp twice a day, and that is around 25 to 30 quarts, and then they get free choice of alfalfa or Timothy hay.
I heard that some pet food companies use yeast from the process of beer. Is any leftover products from beer brewing use for feeding horses?
We don't feed any, but I've heard of people doing it. A lot of it's sent to dairies and feedlots, things of that nature.
What are the sexes of these horses?
These are all geldings. We don't carry any of the mares on our teams. It'd be awful hard on them, the amount that we travel on the road, to be in foal and be carrying a colt. So for that reason, we just take the geldings.
These horses travel in splendor. They're the Rolls Royces of the horse. Horse.
Yes, we have three custom-built tractor trailers. Two of them carry the horses and the portable stalls, and one carries the wagon and the harness.
Now, what's their temperament like?
They are a very good-natured horse, and these ones here are particularly good-natured, I believe, partially due to the fact that our handlers are working with them year-round.
The kids of a century ago, were these the type of horses that they rode in the fields?
These horses, well, it said at one time that these are the horses that the knights rode in the Crusades. And then...
No wonder they took a long time to get to Palestine.
Then later on, they were crossed with the Flemish stallions in Scotland. And we got this very large, high-stepping breed.
How long have they been in the United States?
I couldn't say for sure how long this breed has been in the nation.
So if these are geldings, what do you do when you have to replace one?
Well, we have a breeding farm at Grant's Farm in St. Louis, Missouri. And it's constantly producing new stock for the team.
So you have a regular breeding farm. So you have about maybe 40, 50 horses currently?
Well, altogether the company probably owns 150 head.
So like these horses that we will see in San Francisco will only travel a West Coast circuit?
Yeah, we travel 13 western states and western Canada.
You travel in the wintertime?
Yes, we're going pretty well full-time. For this year, our total time at home will be around 77 days. So it's been a pretty full year.
So the horses are on the circuit about 300 days a year then, huh?
Yes.
Any final comments there, Lloyd?
Well, this bud's for you, I guess.
Strohs, Coors, eat your heart out. This is Peter Paul, down here on Pier 45 with the most famous horses in the world, more famous than the Lipanonzers. This is Peter Paul with the Clydesdale Horses. Thanks for listening.
And we got to give the dogs equal time.
Lloyd, you have two Dalmatians. Are these horses racing to a fire?
No, these are our coach dogs. The Dalmatian, not only used in fire departments, is a coach dog, and with us it's a tradition. They've had the dogs with the teams for 50 years now, and we just carry our two Dalmatians. They're company for us and the horses.
Were they originally used to keep people away from the cask of beer when the man was delivering them?
Well, I've heard that it goes back as far as Egypt, when the Egyptians had their horses and chariots, and the Dalmatian chased alongside the chariot and chased stray dogs away.
What are the names of these dogs?
Our male is Budweiser, and our female is Miss Michelob.
You're not feeding them anything, are you?
No, they won't drink.
Do you have two types of dogs for each team? I mean, do you have two dogs on each team?
Yes. Find that it works better having two dogs. They keep each other company, and in real hot weather, they can change off, too.
So, like, there will always be one dog on the carriage?
Yeah, that's correct.
What do these dogs eat? Now, you're in St. Louis. Do you feed them Purina?
Well, you got to find that black and white dog food.
Well, that could be either. You're out here in the West Coast.
Yeah, we feed them Calcan and Purina High Protein.
Ah, well, being a working dog, they'll need the protein. Well, how old are the dogs? What are their average age?
Our male's going to be 5 in November, and our female was 4 this past May.
Do you have a breeding farm for them, or are they bred on the same farm?
Yes, they do breed some back in St. Louis.
Okay. We won't ask any more questions about what you're feeding them. Thanks, Lloyd, for being on the program.
Thank you.
Okay. We've done about 1,500 interviews when I was in public radio and the school district, San Francisco Unified School District, Western Public Radio. And interviews were done here in San Francisco, several in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and did about 500 out there. So it's a wide variety. We have a rare interview with the Sea Shepherd. They were in the news recently. I just couldn't find the tape, so we will be broadcasting that. And then Mel Belli will be rebroadcasting an excerpt from him, and then from a guy who worked in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office handling the dog bite cases and aggressive dogs, and how they, at the time, things have changed since that horrible dog mauling incident of the lesbian woman here in San Francisco, and he made a homophobic thing out of it when what it basically was, these dogs should not have been allowed to be in that apartment building, and of course the landlord, the manager, and the company that owned the building paid $1 million damages to the partner, the lover of the dead woman. Just horrible, the way the dogs killed that woman. And it may have been something that didn't come up. It may have been nobody's asked, and I've been bitten and attacked by when I had to serve subpoenas and that. Whether or not the woman was wearing something that triggered a reaction in the dogs, that wasn't explored in this case. And those of you who remember, the case was transferred to Los Angeles, and the judge in the case was James Warren, the grandson of the late Chief Justice Earl Warren, who has an interesting background himself. Family had emigrated from, I think, Norway, and so a lot of them, like, had anglicized their names. Like Henry Jackson, the late senator from Washington, was also of Scandinavian, and there's no Jacksons in Scandinavia, nor are there Warrens. But James Warren is retired from the bench. He was in two other notorious cases, very briefly in the Steve Neri case, which we'll get into, and then a case involving 101 California, an office building where there was the biggest slaughter of lawyers in U.S. history. So we'll have some of those interviews. Also, with the late, great Roger Karras, the great announcer and MC at the Westminster Kennel Show, he did a long interview. Also, Dr. Michael Fox, author, the wolf doctor, and did a great interview with him, the Royal Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and very interesting interviews and stuff that we've done. And also, Gladys Sargent, who was the top California's finest and probably premier animal welfare lobbyist. She was married into the John Singer Sargent family and the painter, and she was a part owner of the Oakland Raiders football team. Fascinating woman, partially crippled. Her house was a mess, dogs running all over. She really went to the dogs. She started Pets and Pals. Great lady. She has gone to that great kennel in the sky. And also, we have out of the archives, I'm going to have to replay this, Will Rogers. He died this week in the 30s, and interestingly, it was a plane crash in Alaska, very similar to what happened last week with the late former Senator Ted Stevens. On the plane crash in Alaska back in the 30s was Will Rogers, Wiley Post, I think was the pilot, and then Newt Rockne. Now, Newt Rockne was of Scandinavian descent. He was the great coach at the University of Notre Dame. He became a Catholic. He wasn't a Catholic when he went there. You didn't have to be a Catholic to be the football coach. You just got to win football games. But and there's a famous movie on him, and the role was played by Ronald Reagan, whose mother, get this, Ronald Reagan's father was Catholic, but his mother wasn't, and Ronald Reagan became a member of the Disciples of Christ, or whatever that is. I thought we were all Disciples of Christ if we were Christians. But he played the role of Newt Rockne, and they died on that, not Ronald Reagan, but Newt Rockne, Wiley Post, and Will Rogers died on that ill-fated plane crash in Alaska. But Will Rogers went around the country, and he did these humorous lectures, and they were very apropos to what's going on today, because he needled the FDR administration and the Supreme Court, the unions, talked about a lot of topics. He was born... He was part Native American, born in Oklahoma when it was still the Oklahoma Territory, I believe. I better check my history on that. And he was out here in California, and he talked about a lot of things. Government, he referred to the Canadian case of the Dion quintuplets. Those of you who remember back in the late 40s, early 50s, the five girls were born to this rural Canadian farmer and his wife. They were, you know, they weren't college graduates, and this country doctor delivered them. Well, it became a sensation in Canada, and Life magazine took pictures of them, and the Canadian government got involved. It's just fascinating what they did, and it ties in with government interference in healthcare and dealing with people who use the service. So we'll get into what Will Rogers talked about that. And then in this one, I think we have when he talks about legislatures that these guys, when he was here in Sacramento, the California legislatures didn't have any money. And then we have a similar situation. The legislature has money to pay their salaries and their staffers, but the state still doesn't have a budget. But Will Rogers was talking about the value of these people, these legislatures who, you know, live well off the public, and some of them are what I call political rethreads. You know, it's funny, you cannot buy rethread tires anymore, but we're being offered rethreaded politicians. I won't mention names right now. But here's Will Rogers.
Mayors in this country, there is not who shall be relieved and whose money shall relieve him, but who shall be the one that plays Santa Claus and actually hands out the presents, you know? That's the main problem today, is who hands out the presents. Here he says he should wear the whiskers. And if you can, Mr. Hopkins, they say no, we've got sleigh bells ourselves. Governor Talmadge, down in Georgia, he had a plan. It hit a rut and knocked him right out of the bread line last week. It's been a bad week on plans all around. I'm not going to get discouraged, though. In fact, these other failures, well, they've given me confidence, you know. More hope that my plan will be a success. Now, my plan, to state it in a nutshell, and in fact, that's where all plans come from. And the nuts should never be cracked. But here is my plan in a nutshell. My plan is a plan to end all plans. It's to do away with all plans, that's what it is. There ain't but one place that a plan is any good and that it'll really work, and that's on paper. But the minute you get it off a sheet of paper and get it out in the air and it blows away, that's what it is. Now, Mr. Roosevelt, he dragged more heat plume arms out of little red schoolhouses.
I don't know what happened there, but anyway, we'll get the rest of that. But it's really appropriate to, with all this money that's suddenly going into schools, to pay for teachers. Apparently, somebody's cooked the statistics again. But what Will Rogers, these lectures were done during the 30s, during the Depression, and what Will Rogers was talking about then, in a humorous, satirical way, is very applicable to what's going on today, especially about plans and who's going to be creating these plans and distributing them, distributing the largesse, or as he said, who plays Santa Claus. We got the sleigh bells. And then he refers to Governor Talmadge, controversial governor, was segregationist. He was famous for what they called the Talmadge hams. He was a real porker and was a racist. Of course, he was a product of his time. And I think he was one of these rethreaded politicians. I think he was elected and reelected. He also, I think, either became a U.S. senator or one of his family did. During the late 40s, where we had a lot of controversial senators. We had Strom Thurmond, I think Herman Talmadge. We had this guy, Bilbo from Mississippi, real racist. If you want to see a caricature of Congress, it was done a little later. the film Advise and Consent, where Charles Laughton, who was English, incidentally, played the Southern senator. It was a magnificent performance. And you know, Charles Laughton was gay in his private life, even though he was married in a marriage of convenience to Elsa Lancaster, who knew about his wife. But, of course, they're actors. And then there was Henry Fonda, who couldn't stand gays, who played this typical kind of like an Adlai Stevenson type of politician, very cerebral, although he didn't have holes in his shoes. And then they had a senator who was compromised by homosexual experience he had in the Navy. They tried to blackmail him. That was Don Murray, who later committed suicide. And then the great Canadian who came down to the States, Walter Pidgeon, born in Quebec, like Glenn Ford, although Glenn Ford wasn't in the movie. And Walter Pidgeon had this magnificent bass baritone voice. He played the majority leader. And then we had a Nixon type and a Kennedy type. This film was 1962-63. Great films dealing with American politics. But I'd recommend those of you who like films, and, of course, artists true to life, as I always say, recommend those. We're going to change direction musically. We're trying out a new musical theme. I think it's very apropos. It's patriotic. I didn't realize that I had recorded it back in the late 80s, a live band. And it was written in 1940 when the United States was getting ready to go into World War II, written by Mr. Ray, I think, and Al Jacobs. It's called This Is My Country, and I think it's very appropriate to what's going on today because we have people who have come here and people who are outside who and people who shouldn't be here and should have been deported or should be deported who are trying to disenfranchise not only Americans, and we apply this term, This Is My Country, to people who have come here legally to become Americans. In fact, some of them are better than native-born Americans. If you remember, some of you have immigrant grandparents. When they came here, they may have worked practically on slave level job, minimal pay during the day. At night, they would go to schools to learn English and keep moving up the economic ladder and so that their sons and daughters and grandchildren didn't have to go through the suffering that they went through. And so they made a better life for them, and that their sons could go on to be, and daughters could go on to be, to the professions, doctors, lawyers, engineers, businessmen, that kind of thing. But English was the language they learned, even though they spoke their native language at home. And I might add, never really learned Spanish, French, or German as well as I should have, and even had trouble with Latin as an altar boy. But I do believe that in order to understand and use English accurately and even eloquently, you need to know a second language. But remember, English first. And these people who come here, and we have one here in San Francisco, a guy who's on our city council, came here illegally, and now he's one of the biggest loudmouths saying that illegal aliens, or immigrants as he calls them, and they're not, have special rights, privileges, and exemptions. And these are the same people who are pushing what I call this bicycle anarchy. If you're concerned about, if you drive a car, if you're concerned about high auto insurance rates, this is one of the reasons. There are more and more accidents with bicyclists and automobiles. And bicyclists here in California, some states do regulate, they have, bicyclists have to buy a license. But we have rules of the road which also apply to bicyclists, but they ignore them. And it's not enforced. And it's time to start taking the air out of their tires, as it were. The other thing is, those of you who have been to Europe know, have seen that these are old and famous cities, Copenhagen, Stockholm, places like that, that they're not, they were geared, and as they developed, it's easy to ride a bicycle around, Amsterdam especially. But San Francisco and other cities, you know, this is car territory, and with hills and all that, and it's not conducive on most of the streets and roads for bicycles. I'm not saying that bicyclists shouldn't have a place to ride bicycles. I have one, but I've got to put air in the tires. But the beach, Golden Gate Park, parks around the country, or even Davis, California, where the University of California, Davis, Cal Aggie, the veterinary school is up there, kind of law school. Also, they have a great symphony orchestra. The town is laid out to accommodate bicyclists, but American cities generally have not been laid out that way, planned that way, and there's very little that they can do to accommodate bicyclists safely. So, you know, and then these bicyclists, you criticize them for not obeying the rules of the road. They kick your car, they break your antenna, there's words. So we'll get into this bicycle anarchy. And also go to our YouTube site, found some old photos about Catholic school and some of the role playing that was played. This is before the pedophiles and the political agendas. So go to our AMICUSVERITAS YouTube site. It's called When Catholic School Was Fun. And there's a great piece of music at the end, although you won't see it in Germany. Got a little problem there. But I would recommend that. And those of you who have gone to Catholic school, who are in my age bracket, what do you remember? Do you want to remember anything? If you had kids, are you sending them to Catholic school? Have you sent them to Catholic school? If you have, what's your opinion? So we're going to end tonight with the new theme, This Is My Country.
What difference if I hail from North or South, or from the East or West? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, oh glory, paint the breeze. This is my country, land of my birth.
Of the scaffold, although we haven't yet, and we should, in a manner of speaking, march some corrupt politicians and media people to the scaffolds. We'll leave you with this thought. This election's coming up, and of course I still think there's some of the pundits are overconfident. Being realistic, you know that the corrupt Democrats or Demorats, as somebody called them, are not going to give up power. In fact, they want even more, save even more, or grab even more elective offices so that they can strengthen their grip on power now. So you got to be realistic that, as I was once told by a Chicago politician, I criticized him in an article. I said, if you ever get to be have power, you know, we've got it, and we're going to keep it, and we're not going to let you take it away. You may think so, but until you're in that position, forget it. said a few other things which are unprintable and unspeakable on the air. But anyway, basically that's how these people feel. Well, anyway, this is Peter Paul Brizola. Tune in Friday. We're reformatting the program, and do go to our YouTube site, Amicus Veritas. Thanks for listening, and hope you go there and view. Good night. Okay. Mm-hmm.